Welcome to the psychedelic landscape.
I know, like Paul and Tony, like you guys got fans. It's amazing. So I'm really excited, and I'll give you guys a quick intro to what we're doing at Dot Dot Dot, and me, and then it's all you guys. So for Dot Dot Dot, that's the club that you're in right now. We always want to look at what sometimes people think are controversial topics and that intersection with humanity, and talk about mental health and dig into, you know, lesser known angles of stories with some of the most fascinating people in different industries. So I'm pretty sure this checks all the boxes. A bit about me. I've covered technology for 12 years or something, which like in dog years is like a bazillion, or at least it feels that way. I was our senior tech correspondent at CNN for a decade before launching Dot 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 Media. And you can also see my work on 60 Minutes Plus on Paramount Plus. So enough about me. Tonight's topic is why everybody is here. It's a conversation on psychedelics. The title, which Caroline's amazing, she came up with it. It's Mystical Experiences to Mainstream Medicine. You know, and I think for so long, these practices have been considered French, but I think things are changing as they're becoming more mainstream. And today we're going to talk about fascinating clinical trials that a lot of folks here on stage have been doing. They're at the forefront of. And we're also going to be talking about how this type of thing can help people going through tough times. So I'm co-hosting this with Life Itself founder and Mark, and Mark, if I mess up your last name, I swear to God, I practiced it so many times. It's Mark Hodash?
Hodash.
Anyway, you got it. Mark Hodash, along with mushroom advocate Paul Stamets and psychedelic researcher Dr. Tony Bassis. So Mark is really kind of the brains behind all this because he helped bring together these incredible people, and he is the co-creator of TEDMED, which I'm sure you guys have heard of. And Mark, you have a very exciting event coming up called Life Itself with Dr. Sanjay Gupta, who's like a national treasure, and he once helped my mom when she had a broken ankle, so I love him. So Mark, I'm going to throw it to you. Tell us a little bit about yourself, and we can get into some of the other panelists before diving in.
Well, thank you, Lori. It's a pleasure doing this with you. I'm glad we found some amazing people to kick off a co-hosting conversation. And yes, I love bringing together people connected to health and medicine and art and science from all different angles. And Paul and Tony are two individuals that will be at my event that I'm hosting with Sanjay called Life Itself. And we won't plug it too much, but it is lifeitself.health for anyone who cares to learn more about what it is. And it's, a variety of different topics that we're going to focus on, from things like psychedelics as maybe a session to everything on human aging or the pandemic or medical devices and so forth. And we love to mix art with science. And today I think talking to Paul and Tony about the incredible leading research they're doing around mushrooms is just one of those really fascinating topics that we are still, I think, right on the forefront. But as Paul and Tony will tell you, so much has happened even in the last decade. So I'm excited to talk to them.
Great. And Paul, why don't you introduce yourself? I mean, for folks who don't know, I mean, even doing a teeny bit of research, like you're kind of like a legend in this world, which is pretty, incredible. I mean, you've discovered co-authored four new species of mushrooms, pioneered countless techniques in the field of edible and medicinal mushroom cultivation. Also, I think it was your birthday a couple of days, and I think you wear a hat made of mushrooms, and you have two children, one named after a hallucinogenic mushroom. Is that, please tell me that's true, Paul.
Psilocybe azurescens is the most potent psilocybin mushroom in the world.
Wow.
It was a double entendre, right? So it makes mileage out of naming a species and naming my son at the same time. So
incredible. And tell us a little bit about your work.
Well, I've been involved in psilocybin mushrooms since I was 14 years of age. My brother John came back from Yale. He went down to South America, Mexico, and had extraordinary experiences. And I'm the youngest kid, and we had a large laboratory in the basement, and he was a serious chemist. And he stuck me in the corner, and we had the radio from the aircraft carrier Intrepid. And so I just, during World War II, my father served there on that aircraft carrier and brought the radio home. So I sat there in the corner listening to coded messages behind the Iron Curtain, just very anxious to be a research assistant to my older brother, who I love. And he came back with these amazing stories of psilocybin mushrooms when I was 14. And then he turned me on to a book called Alter States of Consciousness by Charles Tart, University of California, Davis. And that sort of steered my path to where we are now.
And Tony, Dr. Tony Glossis, a clinical psychologist and clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at NYU School of Medicine. And you've been conducting FDA-approved research with the psychedelic compound psilocybin since 2009, so for a long time. And your work focuses on people, you know, with the end of life process. So I can just imagine you must have just seen some pretty incredible stuff, and your work must just be heart wrenching. So that's kind of those are some of the headlines about you, but give us, your intro to yourself.
Yeah. Thank you, Laurie. And thank you, Mark and Laurie, for inviting me in. I'm looking forward to this conversation. I've been very lucky for the past, 12 or 13 years to be working at NYU conducting research with psilocybin, which is the mushroom we're going to speak about today, the ingredient within the mushroom, a very well-known psychedelic, for a variety of clinical indications. And what I've been interested in, as you mentioned, is how these medicines promote these incredible states of consciousness, what we call mystical experience, and have been helping to alleviate suffering in a the distress that we experience at the end of life, the existential distress that people experience with cancer or as they're dying, that we see in palliative care. And we'll talk about that. It's really been a fascinating run. And we really stand upon some of the great research from the 1950s and 60s where this began. And I look forward to talking about that tonight as well, this wonderful history of psychedelics going back over 50 years with people with cancer. So that's one of the primary indications. And I'm also very interested in these states of consciousness these medicines can promote, these incredible states of feeling interconnected and transcendence and meaning making that are found throughout human culture, throughout human civilization. The majority of the religions are built on these mystical core experiences. So it's really an exciting topic, and I look forward to both talking about the history and also the future of this medicine for revolutionizing psychiatry and hopefully healing.
Hey, Paul and Tony, I'm just curious where you guys met each other. I can't imagine this is a very large field, so I'm going to guess it's at a gathering or conference. Tony, I don't think we've met in person, but we've talked a number of times now, and I've had the opportunity of knowing Paul for a decade since you actually spoke at TED Med, Paul, with you, with your research, and I remember the very special moment of you bringing your mom on stage and whatnot. But I'm kind of curious, you guys are coming at this from two different areas. One, you know, the academic university side for Tony, and Paul, the you know, private, just sort of expertise you've developed over the years side. How did you guys meet each other, and how do you work together, or do you share in any way, or are these just two totally separate worlds and parallel tracks?
Well, we met in Vancouver Island and you're right, Mark, at a psychedelic conference. Which was wonderful seeing him. We saw each other from across the room, and I think yelled out, "Brother!" And then right away we felt very comfortable in each other's company. But I've known about Paul for many, many years, obviously, and the great work he's done. So, and now we talk frequently and collaborate on big ideas as this field moves forward.
And Mark, you mentioned Paul. You brought your mom on stage somewhere. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, Paul, you are muted. Just so you know, you have to hit the unmute button. Are you there?
No, it'd be helpful if I would unmute myself. Well, I'm going to first go back and just say I think I met Brother Tony in hyperspace thousands of years ago. So I feel like, you know, we're two brothers from different mothers. But yeah, I was a speaker at TED in 2008 and at TED Med, where I met Mark, I think at both conferences. And my mother, she passed when she was the age of 93, but she came up on stage and had an amazing recovery from breast cancer. And she lived another 10 years. And then, you know, she died about 2 years ago. So my mother was an epitome of kindness and compassion. It's something that I really, you know, very core to my being. And that's where I think these psilocybin mushrooms do. They open up your heart for empathy, and many of the issues that we have today pale in comparison to the enormity of understanding the universe and our place in it. And Tony mentioned the states of consciousness, and you know, those of us who've gone deep into psilocybin, they already know these words, you know, they felt them, but I think we're just seeing a small slice of the reality that surrounds us. And we've been conditioned to see such a small view of reality, and what psilocybin mushrooms do is they open up you into an expanse of consciousness to realize that there are beings all around you. They all have voices. They're all vibrating with different forces of energy. And it's something that you have to feel. It's really hard to communicate, as many people have said, with words. And so those people who are psilocybin naive or psychedelically naive may think these are flowery words, you know, waxing on the poetic. But no, these are deeply, deeply impactful experiences that really, I think, open up the mind's eye that we're in a continuum of different forms of existence, traveling through the cosmos, traveling over time. And we're assembled together right now in this clubhouse conversation. So we're molecular assemblages all coinciding in the same temporal space. That's great. But where do we go from here? You know, 100 years from now, you know, 1,000, 1,000,000 years into the future, into the past. We're all part of that continuum. And I think that we have a responsibility to shepherd this wisdom with integrity and kindness and courage. And it's really important that we do so. These medicines are extraordinarily important.
So, Paul, you say, well, go ahead, Lori. Do you want to say something?
Oh, no, I was just going to ask, you talk about it, and it is interesting, because so not to give the room too much information, but I have never tried shrooms or any psychedelic. But you talk about it, and just hearing you talk about it is fascinating. I'd just be curious to know about your first time and what it was like, because you have become such an authority on it. You know, so much so when you just throw your name out there. You have I think there's a character in Star Trek now named after you on CBS, right? Like, it's, you know, when you go back in history, like looking at your first time, can you just explain, like, in a personal way, what it was that was so life-changing for you, or what was so interesting to you?
Well, I think the story many people know, but I was at Kenyon College in Ohio, and I tried to buy psilocybin mushrooms a few times, and some people can relate to this. I got these frozen portobello mushrooms that were injected with LSD. There was such an interest in psilocybin mushrooms, but such a very little availability, and I consumed a whole bunch of these and barely had an experience, and was ripped off a few times by buying fake psilocybin mushrooms. So someone gave me a bag, and it was, it was what we call a three-finger bag. I'm revealing my drug education here. And I was so disappointed in the previous experiments, I decided to consume the entire bag. Well, that's probably equivalent to about 20 grams. And I knew set and setting was important. I walked out, you know, down this country road. I went up onto a hill where there's the tallest hill in the area for miles, and a big tree was there. And I thought that would be a great place to see, you know, the vista. And it was in the summertime, and these boiling black angry clouds were on the horizon, and they were coming towards me. And as I climbed the tree, I literally was ascending also, and the mushrooms kicked in. And in 20 minutes, you feel this kind of feeling in your stomach, and then a full hour into it, you're skyrocketing. And that was about the time that I was climbing up the tree, and I climbed up the tree, and then that tree became my axis mundi into the earth. I just held on to the tree because it grounded and centered me, and these clouds and the thunder and the rolling thunder, and then I'm up in the wind, and the tree is swaying, and the more it swayed, the more little bit of vertigo I got. So I held on to the tree more, connected me to the earth, literally rooted me to the earth. And then the lightning storm came upon me, and I realized I'm probably in the most dangerous place you could be, you know, tripping on psilocybin. And I was really happy I finally got off, but this is really potent. I didn't expect this. And then the winds and the warm rain, and then the lightning strikes. And then with every lightning strike, there's this massive fractals of all of these different colors and geometric shapes, and every one of them was just, oh my gosh, it was just so visually exciting.
And, you know, I'm big into geometry and all of that. And I thought, wow, this is mathematics. This is like deep mathematics I'm experiencing here. And then the air became like a liquid sea. And then the thunder would roll across the hills and would come to me. It would hit me on my molecular basis. It would cause these vibrations inside of me. And then the winds got fierce and the lightning was crackling all around me. And it was really starting to get scary, but I was like, you know, I'm achieving Godhead. Everything is wonderful. If this is how I die, what a beautiful way to die. And then I still have it a little bit, but I had a severe speech impediment. This is why, Mark, me going up a TED Med or a TED is a real challenge to us stutterers, because if you've seen the King's speech, I was that way or worse. And I went through 6 years of speech therapy and I couldn't overcome my stuttering. And I had this, you know, could the S's, K's, C's, Y's, I couldn't speak. And I didn't stutter when I spoke to animals or when I sang. That's very common, but that's us stutterers. And so it's an apprehension. It's like a severe form of stage fright. And so
this is the area that I'm so curious, because, you know, I haven't, like Lori, had these experiences, but I've always been fascinated about what this research could do from the medical perspective. And you've just given an example of how, you know, the brain is affected and it might solve certain issues. But of course, this gets much deeper when it comes to many other medical conditions. So, Tony, I wanted to ask you, both of you guys are, you know, looking at applying your research either with clinical trials or the FDA and using this from real medical kind of perspective. Could you, Tony, just tell us, what are those trials, for example, that you're looking at now? What is the actual goal? Where do you think it actually will have an impact?
Great. Thanks, Mark. Yeah. So there are many clinical disorders that psilocybin has now potentially helped do a number of clinical FDA trials to really research the safety and efficacy of psilocybin. And the two indications to grow out of the 1960s was with alcoholism and with people with advanced cancer. It's interesting, many people don't know, Bill Wilson, the founder of AA, had many psychedelics that informed his own insight into the spiritual dimension, his own addiction. And the other indication was for cancer patients. Great pioneers from 50, 60 years ago. In 2016, our team at NYU, a team at Johns Hopkins, and at UCLA a few years earlier, published trials showing that of psilocybin could generate this very experience that I'll define in a bit, that immediately caused a dramatic reduction in depression, anxiety, hopelessness, demoralization, and improved spiritual well-being and quality of life in people with advanced cancer, many at the end of life. So we're pursuing, that's one of the tracks we're pursuing.
And can we talk about that one for just a minute? I'm just really curious. Yep. So end of life is an interesting area. Well, you know, as you guys know, one of the things I focus a lot on is aging and longevity, sort of trying to figure out the opposite. But I've always been curious, are you applying this to terminally ill cancer patients to help them cope? Is it a coping mechanism? And is that what it's about?
A great question. So it's not to help with the disease itself, but it's administered to help change, either reduce the existential and emotional distress life often brings up. You know, we don't die well in America, as I often say, unfortunately. We die with hopelessness and depression, anxiety, and profound levels of distress. And we're seeing in our research, one session, and I can describe the sessions in a little later on, one session with the medicine has caused these incredible changes in the suffering of these patients. So they're no longer as depressed, anxious, and in that awful state of angst as we approach the end of our lives. So my hope is within a few years to see these medicines rescheduled and legally available for prescription in very carefully regulated centers in palliative care and hospice, and for people various diagnoses. Other indications that are out there now are for depression, for eating disorders, for alcoholism, so for PTSD. So the field is, you know, being called the psychedelic renaissance, but they're still not legally available yet in terms of psilocybin in America. But we're hoping over the next 5, 6, 7 years that these medicines are available clinically to really help alleviate suffering in so many patients. But in terms of the end of life care, it's been very touching to watch the results. And, you know, all of us have an awful year. It only reminds us about the fleeting nature of this life and this existential dimension to our lives. So I've been very happy to be involved in the research.
Tony, I'd be curious if you could walk us through what a session looks like and what we could expect. I can imagine they're pretty sensitive.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's important to know how it works. Many people don't know. So the most important thing is, and it's remarkable, they take the medicine once. So it's a real paradigm shift in how we view medicine. Most medicines everyone in this room today is taking, they take it every day to achieve that desired effect, whatever that is. The psychedelics really provide a paradigm shift. You take it once or twice, but it's the experience that really changes and recalibrates the person's relationship to suffering and to so many parts of their life. So the way it works is we carefully screen patients to be in the trial, and some people with certain conditions are excluded if they have certain medical comorbidities. There's 3 or 4 weeks of getting to know them. It's really important to develop a rapport and a trust, and so they feel safe, and we prepare them for the session itself. The main guideline is to allow yourself to move into the experience as it unfolds. They lay on a couch in a very comfortable room in a hospital that looks more like a living room-like setting, wearing eye shades and headphones, playing mostly classical-type music. And the purpose of that is to direct their attention inward into the unfolding changes in consciousness. And for about 6 hours, they're in a very dramatically altered state of awareness. And then there's a 3 or 4 week follow-up integration period. By 5 p.m. on the session day, they're back in ordinary consciousness and go home. What we're finding is there's something we call a mystical experience. And there's a few key features of that: unity, a sense of all things being connected and interrelated, the transcendence, transcending the body, as we say, and even time and space. It sounds very, I know, far out, but for the person who's dying and whose body will soon cease, will fail and stop working, the insight or the experience that I'm not just my body, I'm not just this cancer, I'm something more enduring about self or the nature of being, that experience has been shown to be correlated with these reductions of depression, anxiety, and all that. So,
Tony, and actually for both of you. So I can see for a cancer patient who's suffering and depressed and scared and all that, those are really important emotions to treat and deal with for someone who has no other choice and is going through a difficult place. But I also hear about people who have gone through these experiences who are not at the end of life, but they also have that very sort of profound, wow, there's something greater out there. It makes them also fear death less. And I almost question, is that a good thing? Because for a cancer patient, I can see why it's a good thing. You want them to be comfortable. But for the average person, you do want to be afraid of death because it helps you avoid it sometimes. Is there a downside to these things from that perspective?
Well, first of all, you're right. Anyone who takes these medicines can potentially change their relationship to death and dying. But I don't see that as a negative. I think death is our biggest teacher. And if we can move through this life without that fear, which allows us to live more fully. You know, never have people come back to these experiences, including people with near-death experiences, who say they no longer fear death. What actually happens is it's the opposite. They say, I now fully want to live every minute of this life. It has more meaning. These experiences happen in all different populations, not just end-of-life patients, but to recalibrate our relationship to death and to consciousness and people often speak about this incredible sense of love and gratitude they experience, which sounds, again, very new age, but where the science is uncovering this. And those experiences have really, really changed people's lives and their deaths.
I'd be curious, Tony and Paula, what's the most moving experience you guys have witnessed in your career? I know both of you do quite a bit of research and a lot of these experiments. I know we speak about it broadly, but is there anyone specifically that just stands out to you as it was something that was incredibly moving to witness or to be a part of?
I think, Tony, that's a better question for you to answer.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many, Laurie. It's very poignant research, as you could imagine. I, in our cancer trial, I've spoken of a few participants who allowed their story to be public. Many of those were actually in Michael Pollan's well-known book. One of them was a gentleman named Patrick, a lovely guy who died very young in his 50s, and he didn't want to leave this world and his lovely wife. But the experience really helped him cope with that dread and allow him to live his final year with really a sense of presence. And allowed him, because he was freed up of that level of suffering, to be more present for his wife and to appreciate that last year. There are many stories like that where people will talk about just, you know, doing kind of a life review and realizing what makes sense in this world and what's meaningful. You know, we're all of us here. Every one of us in this room gets caught up in this really challenging world we're engaged with. But, you know, one of the insights of these experiences has been this capacity to provide meaning, you know, meaning making to these transcendent experiences that are just touching to watch. And we're scientists. These are FDA clinical trials. But the stuff coming out, the results are showing that, you know, gratitude and love and these and the capacity for making meaning really matters. And I think it matters more today than ever. I think we're at kind of this deflection point in this incredible space we're all in. And I think not just the medicine itself, but these experiences point to something really important. And it's important to say that these occur naturally as well. So these medicines can generate these experiences, but mystical or peak experiences have been occurring throughout human history. They lie at the mystic core of the great tradition, religious traditions. They occur naturally for many people, not in these long 3-4 hour experiences, but glimpses. We all had glimpses of this numinous, of the spiritual. And that's who we are. I think we're wired for meaning. And why that is, there are big questions that are above my pay grade, but it really is a fascinating area to explore. And I'm very hopeful for the future with the medicines and more importantly, these experiences.
Paul, what medical areas are you focused on with mushrooms now that people should know about? Because I know you're interested in, using mushrooms for real medical purposes. What areas?
Well, I'm very much focused on microdosing right now. The question is, like, if you take 25 to 30 milligrams in one day for a peak experience of psilocybin, what happens if you titrate that over 30 days? And so microdosing, there's an app that we're very excited about called microdose.me. We have over 14,000 people subscribing. About half of them are non-microdosers. But we've been able to see some very interesting some observational study that's been vetted and approved through ethics through UBC, University of British Columbia. And Dr. Pam Crisco and myself and other teams, Zach Walsh and Ismail and Caitlin and Sebastian Dar and some other researchers have been instrumental in sort of shepherding this study. And we have a paper that we just submitted to a very well-known journal. We just got the feedback from the journal. We expect it to be published here very soon. It's a very large study in terms of the paper. It's 31 pages long. And it covers thousands upon thousands of reports. And what's interesting, the trends that we're seeing against depression and anxiety are quite significant. But one of the things that we have been able to see, and this is something that Dr. Crisco was very much adamant about, is so many of these studies are 50 to 100 people, 200 people. What happens if you have a really robust data set? Well, you're going to see signal from the noise of some of the outliers. And so what we found, which is just truly remarkable, relates to what's called the TAP test. It is a validated test for Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, dementia. It's basically how they say if you have a traumatic brain injury or Parkinson's, this is a very common test of how often you can tap your fingers, either forefinger to your thumb or alternating tapping. And what we found in the 55-plus-year-olds, there's an extraordinary increase in the tapping over 1 month. and 55 plus year olds, compared to those people who are not microdosing, and even compared to those people who are just taking psilocybin. This is a combination of psilocybin, lion's mane, and nicotinic acid. Psilocybin in and of itself showed an increase across all formulations, and realized that the variability, the potency of the mushrooms being consumed, how often people are taking them, on average, it was 3 to 5 times per week, and about 0.1 to 0.5 grams of psilocybin cubensis. So, but even in amateurize, all these variabilities, which would dilute significance with a combination of niacin, nicotinic acid, the flushing form, lion's mane, and psilocybin mushrooms, the p-value of significance was 0.001. Now, if you had more refined, controlled, you know, dosages of a population and patients, of course, it would even be more significant. So the fact that we had such a strong, I think the numbers went from 45 taps per minute to 70, 75. And I'm just guessing, but I think the psilocybin across all formulations was 45 to about 55. But the p-value for psilocybin across all formulations was 0.041. Scientists will know what I'm talking about. But 0.05 means you have a 95% confidence that the data is significant or accurate. But when you're 0.001, it's 999, you know, over divided by 1,000. So it's a huge. And so what I'm getting at, and this was actually somewhat verified just recently by Yale University, where they measured the outgrowth of neurons in rats that were given a large clinically significant dose equivalent to what you would give to a human for a spiritual dose, which is what Tony's been involved in. But that, and 1 month later, there's an extension of neurons by about 10%. So what I think this leads to is synaptogenesis, neuroregeneration. It grows new neurons. And talking to Parkinson's researchers, there's no test that no substance they've ever seen that increases the TAPS test in Parkinson's patients because of neuropathies. And, you know, this is a dying back of your nervous system to have regeneration of your nerves, as you age.
Do you think Parkinson's will be one of the first areas? I'm trying to get out where you and Tony, I mean, I get where Tony's going with end of life, and I know your research a bit, but just so the public here can understand, what specific conditions do you think mushrooms are likely to progress by? Parkinson's is one. Cancer? What are the areas that you see medically most appropriate for mushrooms?
Well, when you talk about psilocybin mushrooms, I mean, your entire neurological landscape. It's the foundation of your very, you know, being. It affects everything that you're doing. Now, we also found that psilocybin has strong anti-inflammatory properties, spiking interleukin-10s and interleukin-1RAs. And then the entourage effect of these psilocybin analogs also do that. So to have something that causes neuroregeneration and yet is neuro-anti-inflammatory is medically interesting. And so we're finding that these psilocybin analogs that are present in the mushrooms, this is the curious thing. There's not a single clinical study on psilocybin mushrooms. There are 65 approved clinical studies at clinicaltrials.gov on psilocybin. And yet, all these studies are in psilocybin as a pure molecule. And yet, how many people are taking pure molecules of psilocybin? A few hundred in the world. How many people are taking psilocybin mushrooms? Tens of millions. And yet, we're at this strange junction where there's a disconnect between the science that is so fantastic versus the common usage that we're seeing by the population. We need to make that connection. So we're talking to the Veterans Administration. We have about 4 universities. We're very excited to work with us to specifically study that. We're in dialogue with Johns Hopkins and Roland Griffiths to specifically look at psilocybin mushrooms versus psilocybin, all standardized to 1% in psilocybin mushrooms is 10 milligrams. So the idea would you give, you know, 30 milligrams of the psilocybin and 3 grams of psilocybin cubensis, and to see whether they're equal, less, or more beneficial according to the standardized metrics that have already been published. But I think this is very important that with the legalization and decriminalization push, with voters voting for legalization, the government should respond to the will of the people. That's what governments are supposed to do in our democracy. We should be sponsoring these studies to get a real world feedback on what people are really doing. So I think it's great that the psilocybin molecules for their purity, this is leading the way. But I think, you know, look at the, you know, thousands of years of use, and it's not thousands of years of use of psilocybin molecules. It's the entourage of the psilocybin and analogs used in a natural form. So I think this informs us on something that's fundamental, and it could be a breakthrough in medical history if we can then stimulate and become wiser and more coordinated, more compassionate, more thoughtful, more intelligent. I think these are genius molecules. I think, and what I hope is we create millions of Einsteins to be able to create the inventions to get us out of the mess that we have created here. This is what it's going to take, is we need paradigm shifting solutions urgently. And I think we can do that if we stimulate our creativity and we become more intelligent as a species. And I dare say, I don't think we're the same species that we were 200,000 years ago. This is a time for the evolution of Homo sapiens to elevate to a new form of human with a higher intelligence level, a higher compassion level, to understand our context and our role in our society and as Earth citizens. So I think this is much more informative. Now, you talk about just oncoviruses that, you know, that are cause cancer and also are a cause of neuropathies. Of course, that informs that as well. Hmm. So there's a lot of other sort of elements to this. And what we've found with our clinical studies with turkey tail, et cetera, it upregulates immune readiness. And so the idea of being able to nourish your neurons and also be able to get your immune system in a state of readiness, given all the stresses that, you know, that are being inflicted upon us, I think we're at an opportune time where mushrooms are at the nexus of this new understanding of integrative medicine.
And Mark, other uses just quickly is what we're finding in is clinical depression, is for alcoholism, PTSD, for eating disorders, the trials being done now. There was a remarkable study out of Hopkins for smoking cessation, for tobacco. People after psilocybin treatment reduce their desire for smoking cigarettes dramatically. So the clinical indications are really broadening.
And Tony, you spoke, I think Paul mentioned a little bit legalization. What are your thoughts on legalization or the decriminalization of psilocybin and other psychedelics? I mean, where do you think we are and where do you think we're going?
Well, the track I'm on is for FDA trials to have the government federally reschedule these medicines for a treatment of a variety of suffering, depression, addiction, end of life distress, and on for healthcare. So that's the track I'm on. There are other models being pushed forth now regarding states and decriminalization models, but the model we're on is for clinical trials to really assure safety and efficacy. And so in a short time, they can be rescheduled federally to prescribe for people who are suffering. And again, this is one big takeaway for today. The reason why people stop suffering is because of that one experience or two experiences. It's the memories and the learning from that experience. Not just taking the drug every day to reduce a symptom, it's to change the actual reason why they're suffering. It's a very dramatic way, a different way of looking at healing and the self kind of healing impulse in mind, in consciousness. So, but I hope within 5 or 7 years, Lori, with 3 and 7 years, that psilocybin, MDMA possibly as well, will be rescheduled to be used in healthcare to really treat a lot of clinical problems.
To go mainstream, sort of what we're talking about here, and Paul, you and I have talked about this for years, it's got to get away from this, the ideas of the recreational use of this is so different than the medical use of it. And I'm like, you know, do you guys want to see more pharma companies get behind this research? What would it take to do that? Do you think that's important? Do you think, how do we separate these conversations, right? Because I mean, you know, I don't know, Laura, you can tell me what you think, but like, you know, it sounds like you and I don't have much experience with this, and a lot of people do from the recreational perspective. But the medical side, Paul, I mean, your movie, Fantastic Fungi, which goes through all of the power of why these chemicals can be potentially useful and offer a wide variety of functions is, a testament to what the kind of, you know, structure of the mushroom is all about. So how do you get that really into mainstream? What do we need to do?
Well, I have two thoughts on that. I mean, we have two parallel tracks. Of course, there's psilocybin and psilocin. Psilocybin, for most of you may not know that psilocybin is a prodrug for psilocin. So psilocybin dephosphorylates and then and your liver and then your psilocin activates your receptors. So you have the pure molecule, psilocybin and psilocin, and then you have psilocybin mushrooms. Harm reduction and safety is critically important. I had a DEA license for many years. I've grown many, many crops of psilocybes and psilocybe cubensis. And folks, if you just really know the quality controls, unfortunately, people grow them in a basement or a closet. Molds grow, bacteria grow, mites are on them. You know, they need to be grown under CGMP or CGAP conditions, good agricultural practices, which are already in place, you know, for organic mushroom cultivation, for instance, all over the United States. So they have inspectors. And so that can fit in very nicely. I'm an advisor on the Oregon board for the ballot measure 104 that ended up being approved for, I think, in 2 years. It's mandated that the psilocybin mushrooms have to be available. It's an interesting twist in the law that the government cannot mandate something to be legal and then prohibit its use. You're in an inherent contradiction. But nevertheless, the government has a responsibility to protect the citizens by quality controls. And I think that's really, really important. I cannot emphasize that enough. The amount of spoiled mushrooms that make it into a dry bag that people consume at a rave or something, and the endotoxins and bacteria, the adverse reaction potentials, yes, this is a big concern. And people who are a little bit phobic about taking magic mushrooms their apprehension is rooted in fact. Quality control is really important. Fortunately, there are very good people out there who understand this, but there's a lot of people new to this scene who are rushing to economically benefit, who have no history or experience, and it's basically a grab for money. So it says it's the Wild West right now with these new psilocybin companies are forming left and right. And I have serious concerns about quality control, and I think everybody should.
I would just say that's interesting. Having covered tech for a long time, I would say one of the tech trends I'm seeing is I just keep hearing more and more about startup companies in the psychedelic space. It almost feels like there's a psychedelic bubble or something. Are you concerned that it's Silicon Valley kind of trying to cash in on this without some of, the experience behind it? And we haven't really changed the narrative, and we haven't, as Mark was talking about, divided those conversations and really kind of dug into some of the medical uses. I mean, do you worry a little bit about people trying to cash in on that?
Oh, I have huge concerns. But at the same time, there are some good players. I mean, it's as my friend Pam liked to say, someone does one psilocybin experience and suddenly they think they're going to be the savior of the world and they're going to lead the charge as, wow, this is very different from people who are seasoned, who've been doing this for decades, who have been trained, by indigenous peoples or have also have a deeper understanding of the importance and meaning of these substances. So I think economic opportunists and opportunism here is a direct threat. Sure, I do. But also, I have a CGMP facility and I kicking and screaming, but it cost over $500,000 to become CGMP. Good manufacturing practices. And I'm really glad that occurred because the quality controls, anything, if something is moved 10 feet, you have to record exactly, how it was transferred, double signatures, independent people. I mean, the quality controls are really, really important because if you mix something up, of course, it has disastrous consequences. So a lot of people who are jumping into the sea don't have the experience, the depth of experience. And this is what happens is that I would think we've all met people in life who are really good listeners. They can pick up the rap and they can reiterate it. And to the innocent and the uneducated, it sounds really good. But for us, who are more seasoned, we have a healthy amount of skepticism. And I think there are really good players out there. I'm not saying that there aren't. But right now, the rush of new companies without experience is dangerous.
I mean, I think Lori made a good point. We've all seen that a lot of these tech Silicon Valley people that, see this new promise on the horizon and they're trying it, but it almost feels like a parallel to marijuana and weed. And, both probably have really great medical benefits, but you got to target for what they're for. And both probably also have fun benefits, but it doesn't mean you should do it. So
the question is, how do you differentiate? And that's sort of what I'm wondering. And Paul, like, you know, what role do you want pharma to play in this?
Well, people can beat up pharma all day long, but pharma has done some really good things. It's produced some really powerful medicines. They tend to be the magic bullets going after the symptom as opposed to the underlying cause. You know, I'm 66 years of age, and I read that men of my age are taking an average of 8 prescription drugs. I'm not taking any. Who are these people? But how many people? And the problem with pharma is, who has ever done the clinical study of the combining of 8 pharmaceutical drugs in one person at one time? No one. So there's a hubris of pharma that also can be, it's a really big problem of it. But pharma, in terms of quality control measures, has set a really high standard for public safety and harm reduction. I think we can benefit from that. And I think that that has to segue directly into quality controls for the production of psilocybin mushrooms that are likely to be legalized now in California, Washington State. In Washington, D.C., the vote was like 77% in favor. I mean, that's higher than most politicians would ever get. So the people are speaking and demanding this, but growing and having the ability of psilocybin mushrooms access democratizes this process for all ends of the economic spectrum. The pharmaceuticalization, where it costs $10,000 to $30,000 to go into a hospital, in and of itself an austere and oppressive environment that causes apprehension. This is something that's not talked about much in the clinical studies. It's just the fact they're going into a medical facility causes a massive amounts of anxiety, and yet they're using these substances to reduce anxiety. I mean, you can see the complications here. Nevertheless, I think there has to be, you know, everyone, you know, across the spectrum of society, we are suffering from anxiety, depression. And when someone is anxious or depressed and they're not creative, the opposite is true. When they're happy and excited, they're more creative. It's like pebbles in a pond, and every person is a pebble in our community pond. And the reverberations of who you are, is it causing a benefit for the commons by expression of goodwill and charity and generosity and compassion and helping? Or is it centered on selfishness and grabbing all the toys for yourself and not sharing? And so I think we're really at a crossroads here where we have the universality of use of microdosing that can help the commons and the body intellect of our society to be nicer, better, more intelligent people. I think it's that fundamental.
I want to really quick introduce Dr. Carlina and Dr. Owen. You guys welcome up here. And I think, Dr. Owen, you mentioned you had some perspective on pharma, and I think you might have a personal perspective on all of this. So if you want to introduce yourself.
Hi there. It's a real honor to be on stage with everyone. My name is Owen Muir. I'm a child, adolescent, and adult psychiatrist, the founder of the Spirit Club here on Clubhouse. And the biggest honor is I'm Carlene McMillan's husband. And we have two adorable children together. I was talking with Dan Carlin today because we're working together. He's the CMO at MindMed on basically a project for enhancing therapy. And his point from his experience at Pfizer was essentially, you know, they worshipped at the altar 50% better for 30 years. And those are the gods that we got, right? When you take every drug and make halfway less depressed the goal, and you meet those goals, people are really good at meeting the goals we set. And that's not what we see in the effect sizes of psychedelics. We see, you know, relatively speaking, orders of magnitude greater impact on people suffering. And that, for me, is what makes such a big difference, because drugs that, you know, make people less miserable, you know, don't do much for me anymore. I think remission is the goal that I'm looking for. And from my understanding, that's what the promise of these medicines is that remission becomes possible for people in a way that, frankly, Lexapro can't match.
Great. And Dr. Carling, welcome. Anything you want to add?
I'm happy to be up on the stage here in such an interesting conversation. I would love to just kind of ask Paul and Tony what they think about challenges that we'll face as a field in terms of adopting these things. I know the New York Times back in May said, you know, the psychedelic revolution is coming and psychiatry will never be the same. And I think people like me and Owen are, you know, very much on board and very much early adopters. But a lot of our colleagues are not. They're still sort of like, oh, what is this psychedelic thing? And I don't know how I'm going to do this and who's going to pay for it. So what do you guys see as challenges and things that we can do to just get more widespread adoption within our own psychiatric and medical field?
It's a great question. And it also touches back to what Laurie said a few minutes ago about where the field is going. You know, for many people who don't know the history, these medicines were around the 1960s and very credible peer-reviewed university research. And it all came crashing down tragically because of a cultural back in the 1960s and 70s. So I think to answer your question, I think all the science to train doctors and therapists to provide these sessions, that's going to be a big issue in years to come when these medicines are rescheduled and available for therapeutic use. How do we train the hundreds, if not thousands, of therapists who could sit and guide these sessions? And that takes a very specific type of training. So I think it's a serious question and an important one. After the clinical trials are over, you know, how do we go forward and scale this up, so to speak, in a thoughtful and really serious way? Because these medicines and what they can do for people is really profoundly helpful in reducing suffering. And so it'll be awful if this went sideways over the next 10 years. So I think it just behooves all of us as professionals to usher this new era in a very serious and scientific way.
Paul, I have a question. You mentioned microdosing. I just feel like, and I have heard so many people, I remember doing a piece when I was at CNN on smart drugs and microdosing in Silicon Valley. This was ages ago, but increasingly I'm hearing more and more people talking about microdosing. You know, I don't know if this is for medical purposes, just for, you know, productivity, for the mind. You probably can explain it better. Is there anything, as it becomes more mainstream, I guess I have two questions. Why are we hearing more about it now? You know, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like we're hearing more about it now. It's becoming more mainstream now. And is there anything for anyone in the audience, any advice you would give for people who are considering this? And, you know, any advice you would give on microdosing and what to do, what not to do, you know, and just what's kind of behind the reason we're hearing so much more about this now?
No, it's multifactorial, and we're at an interesting junction of, I think, some very big mega trends. So microdosing, for people who don't know, is substansorium. If you take some of the psilocybin mushrooms, you feel an effect, you've taken too much. So microdosing is without an effect that's noticeable, so no intoxication. It's also multi-generational. I mean, it's really interesting. I have so many stories that we hear about grandparents asking their grandkids where they can get psilocybin mushrooms. And so when I was growing up, I couldn't ask, you know, that wouldn't happen with my grandfather to my grandkids. And the grandkids are going, oh my gosh, this is so cool. Grandma and granddad did these things. But at the same time, the caveat, we have to do these things legally. So it's really important, that the legal frameworks are put in place, and then when people conform, again, harm reduction is really important. I think it's happening now because there's been a lot of self-experimentation amongst a lot of people who are telling their friends that, and you'll see in the study that is coming out in the second paper we're submitting here in the next 2 weeks, which is more of a cause and effect paper, it shows that microdosing has a dramatic effect on reducing anxiety and depression. And the neurophysiological benefits that I already mentioned, there's no placebo that could explain the TAP test for 55-plus-year-olds or, you know, it's a neurophysiological benefit. And now we're seeing this neurologically in the experiments from Yale University is confirming this. So I think what's happening is we're all getting older. We're all worried about dementia. We're all seeing older people die, including my mother. she started becoming, you know, having dementia towards the end of her life, loss of hearing. Depression coincides with the loss of the senses and realizing you're at the end of your life. We're all progressing on this same path. And now we can join our hands together and lead each other to a more noble, dignified death. And we can do it. And there's so many, and Tony knows these stories, that it's amazing. Some of these people facing their own mortality, their own death, they do a heroic dose of psilocybin, and then they are the counselors to their family to inform them that it's okay. They're leaving this planet and their family with wholehearted gratefulness and an optimism. And so it's really interesting when the patient becomes the therapist for the rest of the people that are so anxious about somebody else's death. And so we talk about curing people with depression and anxiety. It's just not the person. It's their family. It's not just their family. It's their neighborhood and the cities. And there's a correlation very strong now with psychedelic use and the reduction of crime. Larceny, theft, violent crime, reduction of partner-to-partner violence. And so I think this is a real game changer. And the fact that it is forbidden fruit and bizarre science and from the underground and anti-conventional, hey, that really speaks to young people saying, well, this is contrary to the old school. This is really exciting. But now they have mentors that are elder than them, and they can help lead them on this path with their wisdom of experiences, like psilocybin mushrooms at raves, things like that. You know, I don't want to say I'm opposed to it. I don't like it. I think it's irreverent. It's dangerous. But I understand also the coming of age ceremony when you're 12 to 14, 16 years of age, and many cultures is a coming of age ceremony. So the coming of age ceremony from a child to an adult, I think, is universal amongst all cultures. All that being said, I just think for all those reasons, and now the medical 65 clinical studies at clinicaltrials.gov registered with the FDA on psilocybin. They went through peer review. They went through the board, the IRB boards, institutional review boards. This is not just one or two studies now. This is a massive movement in academia. And the doctors that are not on board, they kind of look like behind the times. They're not up on the science. And, they need to be. So what Tony's work is doing is in particular, I think, is extraordinarily helpful. He's a beacon on leading this movement. So I applaud Tony's work and the people at Johns Hopkins and so many other universities that are leading the charge here.
Paul, two quick questions. How many kinds of mushrooms are there?
Okay. Well, there's 150,000. There's 1.5 million species of fungi, 140,000 species of mushroom-forming fungi. There is 116 psilocybin-active species in the genus Psilocybe, about 200 species of psilocybin mushrooms around the world. So it's cross-cultural, it's circumpolar, it's all over the world there are psilocybin mushrooms. So this bridges cultures. It bridges, brings spiritual bridges between people from all walks of life and so, from the region of the world.
I take it mushrooms are pretty resilient. What's the most sort of resilient environment that you've seen a mushroom in? And to that point, could you ever see us planting mushrooms on, Mars or other places? Is it the kind of, life you could see us using elsewhere?
Well, I have a grant right now. Our team has a sub-grant from NASA specifically on astromycology and growing fungi on asteroids. And I have a group of my scientific team is working on that right now with another group. So that actually is happening because of terraforming, mineralized soils and create rich humus for life. So fungi create soils. So I think we will find that fungi are going to be absolutely critical. The Ganoderma of these polypore mushrooms are very rich in carbon. You could build insulated structures on Mars, and the houses could become nano batteries with solar panels. You could charge the house, and it could become your giant battery bank at the same time. It gives you insulated properties at the same time, recycling waste that you're producing and building soil and to grow more vegetables and more cellulose to be able to grow more fungi, to grow more space habitats on and on it goes. So yeah, this has mycelial momentum right now, and it permeates out into so many different elaborations that boggles the mind.
I would love, before, I know we've got to end soon, I would just love to segue into any personal success of folks up here on stage from, you know, from some of these therapies. I know we can speak broadly about it, but has anyone up here had real personal success when it comes to their mental health or learning anything about themselves?
In fairness, it's why I graduated fellowship on time. So I had the experience of a severe depressive episode right towards the end of fellowship. And, you know, unfortunately, the seasons changed for me. That was the problem. And I couldn't put on my socks. Carlene made a comment on it. It was very sad. I was sitting on the floor of my, you know, bedroom trying to put on my socks and in tears for literally, you know, the change of the seasons. And, you know, I needed to graduate. So I needed something that would work quickly. And ketamine infusions were available. And so I got them. And in, you know, one infusion and then two, the depression lifted in a way that switched off any thoughts about suicide. And that was such a profound experience for me. Because I'm like, oh, so this thing I've been spending my entire career like white knuckling with my patients is something that can just be over in 24 hours? Wow.
Wow. That's super interesting. And I mean, and obviously, right, I'm sure anyone here on stage can say, obviously, a lot of this stuff, people have to do this the right way. And we've looked at kind of the pros and what are the challenges. You know, I know we've got to end it probably in the next couple of minutes. So, Mark, if you want to jump in with anything, I would just love, Paul or Tony, one more question for you guys before Mark can jump in and ask. But what is the craziest, maybe most controversial idea you have that can't yet be proven scientifically, but you might have a hunch or maybe an inclination it might be true in the future that's supported by science? And you can think as big as you want because it's Clubhouse. So it's, you know, whatever you want to do.
Tony, you want to go first?
$1 million question. How much time do we have?
Well, you can, I mean, people will stick around for a little bit. However long you want.
Two quick answers. One, in terms of applications, you know, we're talking about for people who are suffering from different diseases and illnesses, but and forms of psychiatric suffering. I would love to see this down the road, give it to people, you know, astrophysicists, people who are creative. What would it do to their imagination? How would it facilitate their insight? And that's a remarkable direction to go. Also, to give it to family members, caregivers of people who are suffering. In terms of big, you know, big profound answers, you know, I think at the core of these experiences is this mystical experience. And that experience has been around since the dawn of civilization. We're wired for meaning. And I think we're at a very exciting time that these medicines, and more importantly, the experience that they generate, could really help us in this incredible zeitgeist we find ourselves in with climate change and so much political turmoil and global suffering, that these experiences can really help us really promote the survival of the species, in a sense. Not the medicines per se, but what the values they generate. So I'm very hopeful. I know Paul's going to give an incredible answer. I'm waiting for his. But I'm very hopeful about the promise of all this. And I look forward to the next 10 years. It's going to be exciting.
Well, thanks, Tony. I mean, I'll just say, first of all, I think what you're doing to reduce the suffering for terminally ill patients is remarkable and important. I'm a little less bullish than you on perhaps more mainstream usage for getting people to, I don't know, maybe I'm, and I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but accept death or be comfortable or whatnot. These are longer conversations, and I love having them with you guys, but I have this sort of dilemma between these two causes. I think for the end of life folks, it's really, really probably helpful and important. But in general, I want people to be afraid of death and to fight and, you know, to revolt against it and to come up with all kinds of solutions to stay alive. But the point is that, you know, I think that both of you, you know, I'm grateful for Paul. I'm really excited for your talk at Life Itself. Where you're always presenting, I know, some new information and data, and I'd just love to keep exploring this with you and see how we can, you know, further the mainstream medical research
to solve a lot of the diseases and conditions that we have, whether it's mental disorders to, you know, cancer or Parkinson's. I think anything that we can do that might have stigmatized this area and then slowed down research should be fixed. So that, I think, is a good thing. And just really thank you.
Mark, I would respectfully disagree in that having the acceptance of the inevitability of death does not mean necessarily that you have to fear it. So we can go through life with our courage and take our best steps, but I think courageously facing our own mortality is an optimistic endeavor. But I want to, and in terms of the big thinking, and this, I'll get myself in trouble, but I really do believe that all of us right now are seeing the thinnest slice of reality. I think the psilocybin and other psychedelics will give us a portal into the multiverse. And I think that's right now we're thinking about going to Mars in spaceships. You know, I think that we'll be able to use these psychedelics as a tool for being able to enter into the multiverse and in other dimensions incorporeally, not having to have a spacesuit, not having to have a spaceship, that we can instantly then appear anywhere in the universe as one element in a state of universal consciousness, because all we are is just part of one giant consciousness.
Wow. I'm going to end it there with just one quick question. You guys talk about being afraid of death. There's this, you guys have been debating kind of, should we fear death or not? Do you ever fear the work you do, out of curiosity?
Fear the work we do, the work itself?
Yeah. I mean, go ahead.
You know, people often ask, what's it like to work with people who are very sick? It's actually very rewarding in the end. It's liberating. And Mark, I hear you're afraid of death, but,
I'm not saying afraid of death. I just want to clarify. I just think the human body, you know, fight or flight, right? That's there for a reason. So I want to be cautious about diminishing that effect when it comes to et cetera. So it's not so much about the fear of death, but just the reaction you get to fight against, you know, those things, and not just accept them for what they are.
Right. Well, fight or flight, to have that, I mean, that's a lot, source of a lot of also diseases, low level fight or flight response. You know, to be liberated from that fear allows us to live more fully.
Great.
Go ahead.
Oh no, sorry. Go.
Just quickly, that it's actually really, it's very liberating. It's the opposite of being depressing to work with people at the end of life and to do this research. It actually is very life affirming. By accepting these realities of who we are, it does liberate people to live more fully. So it's actually profoundly meaning making, not depressing.
That's great. Well, I really appreciate everybody joining tonight. You know, if you've enjoyed it and you're looking for more, Mark, I think you guys also have a club too, right? It's Life Itself on Clubhouse. So thanks for joining .. And Mark, right? It's called Life Itself.
We do have a Life Itself club, and you know, we've brought on folks from Dr. Fauci, and we'll have future ones, and hopefully Lori will do some more together too. But I just want to say thank you, Paul and Tony. This is a really fascinating and complex area, and just love chatting about it with you guys.
Yeah, and if you guys enjoyed it, you can also, I know Tony and Paul, you really, really quick plug, you have a movie coming to Netflix in a couple of days, July 28th. Is that a couple of days? I think that's tomorrow. I don't even know what day it is. So can you tell us the name, give a quick plug on it? I'm sure people who are here would love to watch it.
Well, many people have seen Fantastic Fun Drive. There's a really big announcement happening tomorrow. Louis Schwarzberg and I are on an Instagram video live, and he'll be announcing it. Basically, the movie is going to be seen by hundreds of millions of people, and Louis will save that announcement for tomorrow. But please go see a Fantastic Fun Drive or rent it if you
have. It's a beautiful, beautiful film, Paul. And by the way, I think it was produced by Lynn and Norman Lear, and today's Norman's 99th birthday. So shout out birthday to Norman.
And thank you. Thank you deeply, Mark and Lori and Tony and Carolyn and Dr. Carlene. Great. Really appreciate. And thank you, Owen, for joining as well.
Thank you, everyone.
Perfect. And guys, just remember, Life Itself is The conference is September 28th to October 1st, not to over promote it, but I mean, it's going to be fascinating because look at the folks on stage. And, you know, I think next week we have another panel at 6 p.m. and it's on God and tech. So we're taking on all the philosophical things. We have Kickstarter co-founder Yancey Strickler and the founding members of AI and Faith. So appreciate everyone being here tonight. Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much, Lori.
Thank you, Lori.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, guys.
Take care. Bye-bye.